Hello, Tiger Nation. I am Byron Hulsey, headmaster at Woodbury Forest School, and I would like to welcome you to the Woodbury podcast series. This podcast consists of informal yet substantive conversations with alumni, faculty, staff, and students. The conversations explore how Woodbury's core values empowered alumni to build a solid foundation for their lives, how those core values are taught today by Woodbury teachers, and how those values are put into practice by today's students. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Woodbury Podcast. Really happy today to have Paul Cumbo join us. Paul is an author who has recently written a book about men called A Path to Manhood, very, very recently published to much positive critical acclaim. I've been looking forward to this conversation, Paul. I appreciate you joining us. And I would just like to start, after the warm welcome that we want to offer you, to just ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of how you grew up, how you've spent your time, how you became interested in a project like this.
Well, thanks, Byron. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you. And I appreciate the interest and the listening of everybody down at the Woodbury Forest community. I was born in Buffalo, New York. That's where I live now. And I've lived there most of my life, except for 1 year of grad school at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Mm. And I lived and taught at Georgetown Prep in Bethesda, Maryland for three years. But other than that, I've been here my entire life. I grew up as one of five brothers. My parents are in healthcare. I was raised Catholic, attended Catholic elementary and middle schools, as well as a Jesuit high school where I now teach and have been teaching for about 20 years. I studied English in college and then began teaching. And in fact, the first week of my teaching career was the week of 9/11, just 11 miles from the Pentagon. And that had a big impact on my life. Taught for a few years there, went off to grad school, made my way back to Buffalo. And then the most important moment in my life occurred when I met and married my wife, Megan. Mm-hmm. And we're in our 15th year of marriage. We have three really wonderful kids who are in those fantastic ages around 9 and 10 and 12. And they're really, really just the most fantastic aspect of my life. So I love my teaching. I love my family. And I love the vocation of writing and storytelling. But that's my life in a nutshell.
Do you have all sons, a mix, all daughters? What's the story?
It's a boy, girl, boy.
Oh,
so
wow.
Matthew. Matthew is going to be 13 in the summer. Kate is about to turn 11, and our son Ben just turned 9.
I don't want to assume anything. Are you a Bills fan?
I am. You have to be a Bills fan up here in Buffalo. It's not even so much a requisite that you love football, but there's spirit to that team, and there's an underdog spirit to the city that the Bills really, really encapsulate. Josh Allen and company have just done something really magical over the past few years, and it's a wonderful, wonderful spirit to get behind, whether you're a football fan or not. So I'm a football fan by default.
I remember the long-suffering Cubs fans back in the day before they had won a World Series. They suffered and suffered and suffered, and I almost felt when they finally won the World Series that it was kind of like a disappointment. You won't feel that way, will you, when the Bills ultimately win the Super Bowl 1 year?
Well, I'm glad you said when, because I do think it's a when, not an if.
Yeah.
No, I don't think there will be any disappointment. I think that those of us up here in the city of Buffalo will consider it something that has been long fought for and long deserved and
long overdue.
Take some healthy pride in it, sure.
Well, that's good. I hope for the sake of the Bills fans that is sooner rather than later.
Yeah, we hope so too. You know, I'll tell you, Josh Allen has been, he's really been just a fantastic force in the city. You know, such positivity. And in keeping really with this conversation, I think he's been a fantastic model for, you know, for the kind of character-driven leadership that you would hope to see in today's young men. And it's really been uplifting. You know, there's so much negativity that you can sometimes see in celebrities and athletics and whatnot. And this guy, he's just a class act. You look at the way he runs to winning and losing, and what a wonderful example.
Are there specific things that he has done that have really, you know, impressed you and that you would share with, say, the Woodbury boys about what it means to be a good man?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's a young guy who, you know, make no mistake about it, makes a phenomenal amount of money. He's done very well for himself as a professional athlete, but he is tremendously generous and has, you know, taken the initiative to begin a foundation that has done fantastic work for Children's Cancer Hospital here and is just a, how do I put it? I think it's the humility. You know, I'm always impressed, Byron, by people who can truly excel in their field, whatever that field might be, and maintain genuine humility. I don't think it's an affectation. You know, maybe it is. If it is, it's a really good one. But I think there's a genuine humility there, and somebody who can, as we often say to, you know, to boys we teach, you know, win and lose with class. Yeah. I see that and I admire that. And I'm not even the world's biggest football fan, but I see that kid play. Here I am calling him a kid. I'm showing a little my age, 45. Yeah. But I see that kid play, and I'm mesmerized by his abilities, but I'm even more impressed by his ability to carry his team in terms of character and maintaining the spirit of optimism and generosity and humility.
Tell me a little bit about the book, A Path to Manhood. What triggered you to do the research to put this together? I'm really interested in kind of the backstory for why this book and why now for you.
It's interesting to explore the origin story of a work, particularly a nonfiction work, because I've written novels, okay, and I like telling stories. And this one was a different animal, and it emerged out of a desire to chronicle many of the twists and turns of the journey that I've taken growing up, as well as what I've observed in decades of conversation with boys going through that complicated terrain of adolescence. And one of the things that I came to appreciate very acutely as a young man is the value of transformative pilgrimage, the value of transformative travel. I had a fantastic experience that I describe in the book in some detail to go to the Nepal Himalaya at a time in my life when my perspective on things was rather closed-minded. And that experience of traveling to the other side of the world, being immersed in a completely foreign culture, coming to grips with the reality that the world was much bigger than I thought it was in so many different ways, reminded me, and I suppose opened my eyes to the fact that I had a place in that world, and that was a gift. Ever since then, I have looked at life as a pilgrimage, as a journey. And when I encounter students, as I have from when I was just a few years older than they are, now to the point where, you know, some of my students are very close in age to my oldest son, I look at their stage of life in adolescence and into their, you know, 20s and 30s as the students grow up. I stay in touch with many of them as a mentor. And I'm fascinated by seeing the journey that they're on and the transformation that they undertake, not necessarily in the Nepal Himalaya, but in the peaks and valleys of successes, of failures, and what a privilege I have found it to be to accompany them, to be somebody that many of them will approach, you know, in trust and confidence, ask for guidance, simply share some of the struggles, some of the joys. It makes me feel very, very much alive. And so the book is, it's a celebration of the pilgrimage that each of our lives comprises. And it's aimed to be a guide that does two things, as the subtitle suggests, both encourage and advise. And I think those two things go hand in hand. I think in some ways they're codependent. I got a message literally 45 minutes ago from a former student of mine who read the book and told me, he said, you know, I'm in my 30s now, and I just want you to know that the things you've written helped me figure out some very important things over the past couple of days.
Oh, wow.
He didn't That's go great. Into any detail, but you know, Byron, that is the kind of, you know, how redeeming, what a gift that was to hear.
Yeah.
My hope is that the book is able to serve others in that way.
It prompts a question that maybe you'd be willing to ponder with us, you know, in the podcast. When young men are reaching out to you for advice, what in particular are they wanting to know? What's going on in their lives that has them perhaps hung up a little bit, challenged in a way that they feel like they'd like a little extra counsel from a trusted confidant like you?
I think sometimes they're looking for affirmation that is fuel for good decision-making. You know, in I'll give you an example, not a specific example, but the type of thing I'm talking about. You know, I'll talk to a kid who is considering, I'll look at a kid in high school, you know, and he's considering changing sports. He's been on one team for a couple of years. It's something that he has done since he was in middle school, perhaps. And he's found that he's at a different stage of life, you know, perhaps as a junior, and that what he has always done, just it isn't working for him in the same way that it used to, because he's a different guy than he was when he was in seventh, eighth grade, you know.
Right.
You're smiling. Your listeners can't see you smiling, but you are, because I know you've heard the story before. And, you know, the kid will come to me and say, geez, you know, I am a hockey player. I've always been a hockey player. And I said, well, you're also 16 for the first time in your life.
Yeah.
And, you know, every age we're at is the first time we're at that age. And, right. You know, he'll be exploring something different. You know, I'm thinking about stopping that and, you know, maybe playing, I don't know, baseball or something else. And sometimes kids are just looking for somebody to hear them out, to let them talk through their own discernment process. And as you know, as a fellow educator, a majority of teaching is listening and allowing a kid to know that he's been heard, that he's been listened to. And oftentimes the best answer I can give is, well, it sounds like you've already got this figured out in your heart. If you're asking if I think it sounds good, I said, yeah, I think it sounds good, you know, and that's not always the case. Sometimes it doesn't sound good. And then you can, you know, then you can kind of help give the kid a little bit of guidance in the other direction. When it comes to the older guys, and this is in some ways, I won't say it's more interesting terrain, but I guess the stakes are a little higher sometimes.
Sure.
It's the questions of career discernment and vocation. And sometimes it comes right down to the big decisions like, you know, getting engaged or marriage, or, you know, maybe a religious vocation or a military vocation or whatever it might be. Even though the stakes are higher and the circumstances are different, in many ways, it's the same question. It's, I am discerning something in my heart. I'm doing my best to listen to authentic desires and to tune out those things that might be false desires. This is what I think and feel. How does it sound to you? And so often, more often than not, it is a question of affirmation mixed with a little bit of healthy challenge, a little bit of appropriate skepticism. And it's talking it through. You know, they're looking for a sounding board. And I take great joy in that. And I find it very affirming as a teacher, as a man, as a husband, and as a mentor.
On the path to manhood, what are the biggest obstacles that you see? And what is the advice that you provide the reader for how to navigate those challenges and those obstacles?
Well, there are many obstacles, and they're going to differ, of course, for different people.
Right.
Some young men are going to deal more with the obstacles that are self-imposed. You know, they might be aspects of their personality. They might find themselves introverted to a point where they find it very difficult to, you know, to interact with people on personal levels or with groups the way that they would like to. But oftentimes the forces are external, and they're things that threaten to derail the healthy development of young men. You know, as a fellow educator, as I imagine a number of your listeners would agree, the online landscape presents a veritable minefield for any young person growing up, you know, guys and girls alike. I think that there's tremendous opportunity online to do constructive things, but those constructive things are far less flashy and attractive than the things that are potentially destructive and at best distracting. To the point where they create a sort of exhaustion and a fragmentation of attention. Mm-hmm. Everything is flashing in 52 different directions, and it's hard to lock in and focus. I think that's a real challenge, that level of fragmentation. I was mentioning to some people on another podcast that it has always been difficult to separate the signals from the noise.
Yeah.
Now there are millions of signals, and that's different from my generation or your generation. There are many, many, many more signals coming in every day from many more channels, and there's a lot more noise, and it's harder to tune out the noise. So I think those are some things that young men are really struggling with. One of the things that is a combination, I think, of external and internal forces that I've seen with relative frequency is a sense of, how do I put it? Fatalism is too strong a word, because that sounds very dire. That sounds very morbid. But a certain sense of paralysis that sets in either following a failure or prior to a potential failure. You know, in other words, a hesitancy to a sort of a risk aversion that leads to paralysis by analysis. And those are two different things, but they sort of they sort of manifest in similar ways because they create an aura, an aegis of fear around a young man. And I don't think that's unique to just young men. Okay. So much of what I'm saying, I think, would apply to any young person. But I'll tell you, you know, sometimes you'll see a guy, he will have done something and it didn't work out. And then there's a sense of, well, that didn't work out. Maybe I just can't work things out. And he freezes.
Yeah.
And then it's paralysis. And that to me is very, very destructive. That's something that threatens the healthy development of young men. And the fact that they can be so subject to so much criticism when they do anything wrong, again, not just young men, young people today, if you do something wrong, it's often recorded, broadcasted, and screenshots are forever, you know, and that's tricky territory. So I think it's a hard time to grow up. I don't think it's harder to grow up now than it was, say, in the Vietnam era or World War II. No, I mean, that wouldn't be fair, but I do think it might be more complicated. And there's a difference between difficulty and complexity.
Yeah, there sure is. I grew up in the, you know, I'm graduated from high school in 86. I think it's much, much more complicated and more challenging now than it was then. You may have watched or heard or read Roger Federer's graduation speech at Dartmouth last year. He shared that he won 80% of his matches, but only 53% of the points played. And at first, that doesn't really compute. But obviously, he won the most important points.
Right.
And what's so interesting is that he said, you know, in tennis, you lose a point or it's a great point or a terrible point. Only thing that's known is unless it's the last point, you got to get ready for the next one. I mean, it's that kind of discipline that is not that easy for us to develop, but to flush what just happened, whether it was good or terrible, and get ready for the next play.
Yeah, that kind of resilience. You know, it's interesting because somebody might look at that and say, having such a readiness to get right back at it.
Yeah.
It almost appears a little bit arrogant.
Yeah.
And it might, you know, but I'm going to flip that on its head. And I'm going to say, to me, that it's also a form of humility because it says, you know what, my failure, I'm not that big a deal. And neither was my failure. And
right.
If I appraise the significance of my failure too high, it sounds a little ironic, but there's a certain arrogance to that. It's kind of like, get over yourself, man.
Yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah, you're not that important.
Yeah. You've got, you know, and neither was your failure, which is not to, you know, let anything off the hook. You know, if people take responsibility for what they do. But I do think there's an aspect of resilience that is contingent upon being willing to accept the fact that you're a broken human.
Right.
Have human brokenness about you. And you should just anticipate that in your pursuit of excellence, you are not going to achieve perfection. The willingness to get back.
Stop trying.
Yeah, yeah. So important. Such an aspect of strength.
The language you just shared about being a broken human being, it has reverberations around faith. You know, you went to a Catholic school, you've taught in Catholic schools. We've never met in person. I don't want to assume that your faith is necessarily very important to you, but I'm just wondering, how has that informed your research, your teaching, your work on this project?
I wrote a Substack column recently, and the title was, "Can Faith Run So Deep That Sometimes You Forget It's There?" And I'd love to, you know, maybe I can send you a link to it. I'd love to point people toward that. My faith does run very deep. It runs sometimes, I think, so deep, and I'm not bragging about it. You know, I've wrestled with this. Sometimes I think it runs so deep that even when I question it, there's sort of a subconscious, like, you're not actually questioning this. You know, you're taking yourself on an intellectual journey, but at the end of the day, you believe what you believe, and it frankly underpins everything that you do. It even underpins the way that you're approaching that intellectual, you know, debate in your mind, right? So my faith has been very important to me. I've been raised and educated by the Jesuits, and the Jesuits are an order of Catholic priests, the largest order in the Catholic Church. You know, Pope Francis is a Jesuit, and the Jesuits are all about education and service. Okay. Yeah. And I've been taught, you know, all along that you can find God in everything. It's an underlying principle of St. Ignatius, Ignatian spirituality, which is espoused by the Jesuits. And because you can find God in everything and everyone, everything is a gift, every opportunity, every experience is a gift. And even those that are unpleasant or unfavorable have a certain gift-like quality to them that enable us to grow and to get closer to the man or woman that God is calling us to be. And so, you know, that fundamental belief that life is a gift of pilgrimage, if you will, if I can hearken back to our conversation a few minutes ago, puts me in a place where I believe that every person is intentionally created, exists for a reason, is not arbitrary, and therefore is a gift to look to the world, you know, to other people. That gives every person a degree of sanctity that I think is deserving of encouragement and advice. And I guess, you know, we're orbiting back to you, to your previous question. I think that lies at the heart of what I wanted to do with the book, was to remind young people at a time of their life that is oftentimes very challenging and can be sometimes very desolate, that, hey, man, remember something. You're a loved child of God. And you might not be religious. So I'll put it to you this way. I believe you're a loved child of God. Okay. Even if you don't, let me just tell you that you matter. Can we start with that? You know, can we acknowledge that you matter? And sometimes, and you know this from your years in education, dealing with guys, when somebody is in the depths of male pattern depression, there is a lot of doubt about whether or not he matters or anything matters. And that's a tough place to be. That's a dark place to be. I've spent a little bit of time there in my early 20s, and I was able to emerge from that through a combination of faith and love and hope and all of those things that are so important. So I'm at a stage in my life where I have a great deal of confidence and joy and happiness in the journey that I've lived. I'm very grateful and happy to be able to share that through the means of my storytelling and my writing.
Can you unpack for us a little bit what you mean when you refer to male pattern depression?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm not a psychologist, okay? So I'd have to go, you know, Google things to get the terminology exactly right. But what I mean by that is the particular aspects of a depressed state that tend to manifest in men, which are a little bit different than the way that they tend to manifest in women. And the word tend there means that there's a great deal of overlap. But I think very often, you know, when you're looking at a young man or perhaps a teenage boy who is depressed and exhibiting some of the things that psychologists would refer to as male pattern depression, one of the things that you see is locking up and shutting down.
Yeah.
It's a withdrawal, you know, and it's not necessarily going to manifest in a lot of crying and weeping and tears and, you know, that extroversion of emotion. In many ways, it's going to be the opposite. It's going to be the clamming up. It's going to be the withdrawing. It's going to be the curling into an existential ball and being paralyzed. And that you combine that with the tendency that most boys and men have not to be very emotionally fluent, inclined toward vulnerability and sharing that vulnerability in a verbal capacity. You put all that together, and then you sprinkle in the cultural expectation of stoicism and manly toughness and, right, you know, resilience by default. And man, that's a pressure cooker. And I know that you've seen what that can do to some young people who appear by all other means to be, you know, quite strong and secure. And I think we see that manifesting in a lot of the observable statistics around depression and suicide and loneliness, the loneliness epidemic among American men.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's a lonely place to be.
Sure.
And all the research says that your friends and your healthy relationships are the best thing that you can do to stay healthy.
Yeah, they are. I think they're super important. And, you know, when you live and work in schools like you and I do,
right,
and I don't pretend to know too much detail about your school and I imagine vice versa, but at schools where there is a healthy culture of camaraderie and brotherhood in the healthy sense, not like we're all bros here and we just cover each other's back, but that's right. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. When there's a healthy culture of genuine brotherhood and accountability and the kind of emotional intimacy that that creates among a group of young men. And that's fantastic. But maybe you've seen this, I imagine you have. One of the challenges that presents that I've seen over the years is that when you emerge from that out into the big bad world, it's very different out there. And I think a lot of young men find themselves emerging from places where they felt a great deal of camaraderie and close bonds and friendship into a young adulthood where that's much more difficult to replicate and find.
I think that's the hardest, that's the biggest challenge our boys face when they go to college. They scratch that itch with, generally speaking, fraternity life, and they hope that that covers it, but it only covers a portion of it. In my experience, I find young alumni telling me fairly routinely, you know, I miss Woodbury. I mattered there. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like I matter now. That's a really big deal. I visit with seniors in small groups of four. We have 100 boys per class. And so I do this every year. And I have these kind of exit interviews with the seniors in these small groups. And at the end, I always offer a little bit of life advice. And the best advice that I feel like I can offer is that, you know, when you came to Woodbury, you just kind of plopped down here and you were surrounded by us who are totally committed to knowing you, challenging you, and loving you. And the hardest thing about leaving here is that the rest of the world is not like that. That will never happen again in the kind of way that it's happened here. My best advice for boys in that kind of, or young men in that kind of scenario, in that kind of situation, is they have to be very conscious about surrounding themselves with people who are going to make them better.
I think that's a super important point. And you know,
you can do that, but you have to be conscious about it. It won't just happen.
You do. Yeah. And of course, you know, as we would advise those boys and young men, the older you get, the less you're going to find that done for you. And
right.
The more initiative you're going to have to take to do it. I think one of the cruel ironies about, you know, the culture for young men, I think, you know, kind of young bachelor life in the 20s, is that from what I've seen, most young men crave that close bond of emotional intimacy that they knew as boys. Not everybody. You know, I'm speaking in generalities. I mean, there are some guys who go through their adolescence terribly lonely, right? But I think in general, there's a broad craving for that, and yet you don't hear much about it. So it's almost like you look at a group of 100 guys in their mid-20s. I bet you 80 of them really, really crave, you know, that kind of connection, that sort of being a part of a band of brothers or a pack or a tribe or whatever, right?
We're social animals.
Sure, but they're not going to say that because it sounds weird and the culture looks at it askew. And then in the worst case, you know, you've got organizations or you've got gravitational centers that feed on that in the most negative way and draw guys in and say, well, you can be a part of us. And the ethos there is very often the kind of thing that, you know, delves into the misogyny or the homophobia or the, you know, the most accessible, easy, cheap things to gather around as a pack, you know, where nobody really has to actually open up about anything. We can all just act like tough guys. So there's an irony there because you're not yet, you haven't actually achieved what these guys need and want at their core. So there's a dearth of, I think, opportunities, and there's a cultural lack of encouragement for boys and young men, or excuse me, young men, I should say, not boys so much, to get together and to, you know, to gather and to do things, be friends. And that's not a matter of opinion. I mean, it's observable. There's the loneliness, you know, the statistics around loneliness are, you can go out there and you can find them. They're really scary. Statistics around suicide are even more frightening, right?
Paul, I'm really excited about your book. It's been fun for me to have just a chance to get to know you a little bit and to hear a little bit about the book. I look forward to reading it. And I'm sure that, you know, given the fact that we're an all boys, all boarding school, it'll make its rounds here in the Tiger Nation. But I appreciate you being on the Woodbury podcast. Our guest today is Paul Kumbo. The book is A Path to Manhood. thank you so much for giving us a teaser on the book, Paul. Congratulations on its publication. And thank you for all you do to support the lives of boys and young men as we look to support boys and young men being leaders, scholars, and citizens. So thank you, Paul.
Thank you so much. I wish you all the best for the remainder of the school year.
Thank you so much. Go Tigers.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Woodbury Podcast. We hope you found our discussion insightful and engaging. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing, rating, or leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. Stay tuned for more conversations in the future. And remember, the conversation doesn't have to end here. Connect with us on Woodbury Forest School social media, reach out with your questions or comments, and let's keep the dialogue going. Until next time, take care and go Tigers!